Good morning. We are convened to hear the case of Secretary of Labor versus Altour Inc., Avcon Inc., et al. Mr. Gottlieb?
Yeah, he wanted to go first. I don't know. Because he had made the motion.
Yeah, my minutes show Mr. Gottlieb as first, but
I defer to what the court wants.
I think we ought to hear from counsel for Altour, Avcon, Sites.
Thank you, Your Honor. Paul Sands, III, one dress compositing on behalf of the respondents, movements.
Good morning, Your Honors. We're here today to move to affirm in part and reject in part the report and recommendation of the master, which was dated March 22, 2017. Three aspects of the R&R we would ask that you confirm. The first is that Avcon is not...
Before we get to that question, Mr. Sanders, the resolution of those questions, the one significant legal question that seems to exist here is, what is the applicable standard for our review? That would seem perhaps to be unsettled. So can you help us with that?
Yes.
We have factual findings made by a special master and the report delivered to us. So what do we do with them?
Well, under the NLRB case, as Your Honors are aware, there was an understanding that even though federal rules did not apply to this court, they were applied by analogy. And at that time, Rule 53 held master's review was clearly erroneous. I don't think there's any question about that. Since that time, in 2003, the rule was amended. And when you look into the reason for the, I think the overwhelming background is that masters have done more substantive factual and legal findings since their use has begun.
Might that not violate Article 3, however?
Well, but I direct Your Honors respectfully to this court's case, McCallan versus Commissioner of New Jersey Department of Corrections, 419 Fed App Appendix 31, where this court said, and that was a case where the facts were stipulated, and the court said, but whether facts support a cause of action involves application of law to facts, and we will review issues of law de novo, looking directly to the special master's binding factual findings to determine whether they establish the legal arguments required for relief. And that's precisely what we're saying here, Your Honors, that the factual findings with regard to Altour's inability to pay, the question of the health deductible reimbursement plan using monies from the employees, not Altour's money, and the issue of whether paying legitimate business expenses allows the company to stay in business are all reviewable by Your Honors. But the key fact that's missing...
Well, hold on. Before you get too deeply into the facts, I'd like to explore a little more what Chief Judge Smith had to say. So you're advocating for a de novo standard of review, right?
Well, there's no question that the rulings of law, the conclusions of law are...
I'm saying on facts.
Right. How you apply the facts to the law according to the McCallum case, this court has said it's de novo.
Was that the same set of circumstances as here, though?
Well, this was a case where the facts were stipulated, which is one of the exceptions in the review.
I just wonder how, I mean, maybe we could explore a little bit, how would de novo review work in this court? I mean, I can understand in a trial court how they might have de novo review. They could have a hearing. We don't do that. We're a reviewing court, so how does that, how would
we apply?
Your Honor,
if I was writing a remand order, I would direct that the master make certain additional findings.
That's true, but that doesn't answer the question, though. At some point, you may say, I don't agree, and there's, you know, he saw this, don't agree. How do we apply de novo review in this court?
Well, if you defer to his factual findings, you still have to apply them to the law. And the inability to defend.
Okay, but that's the second step. How do we, look, he's got findings. What do we do with those findings? I think you're arguing it should be, we should be reviewing that de novo, which means there's no deference at all given to them.
We're saying it's a de novo review, but in particular.
But the import of Judge Chigares' question is that such de novo review is conducted then by a forum that lacks the same advantages, if you will, that a first instance court making factual findings has. For example, being able to watch a witness testify, being able to assess demeanor, all of that is not available to what is ordinarily a reviewing court on a cold record.
That's correct, but there were no witnesses here, Your Honor. Now, if you don't accept my argument that de novo review of the facts is applicable here.
Well, stop right there, though. I mean, the point you make is a valid one. Would it be possible, would it be practical to adopt a rule of, or rather standard of review that applied in those situations where the reviewing court is looking at either stipulated facts and or documents and similar forms of evidence and apply a different standard of review where testimony that is subject to questions of credibility are at issue?
Well, I think that's why in the NLRB case versus Local 3, they deferred to the master because there were credibility findings. Here we're talking about tax returns and bank statements to show whether Altor had the ability to pay or not. But it goes further than that because the master found that Altor could have paid a modest sum. And then
doesn't this case really come down mostly to that? And I have to say that is an aspect of this case that troubles me, as it obviously troubled the master. I look back to the days when I was a state court judge and I would have parties in family court in front of me, support cases, where a parent was ordered to pay X number of dollars, and the parent could have paid Y number of dollars, a lesser amount, but instead chose to pay nothing at all. And often that parent ran afoul of contempt for that very reason. How is it that we could countenance your client simply electing to pay nothing?
Because the question is, did it have to change its business practice by either not paying a lawyer, not paying an accountant, or not paying health insurance, or not paying employees, all of which would cause the company to go out of business? That's our argument. However, I want to get to the
individual. So we should afford sole discretion as to what and who to pay to your client, given the limited number of the limited amount of funds that are available to him or to the business entity.
As long as they're legitimate business expenses, in the absence of payment of which the company would go under. That's not the purpose of the OSHA Act, to put people out of business. That's our point. And I'm suggesting that if you remand the case to the master, that he make a finding of exactly what he believed Altor could have paid. And that's very important because the second...
That is absent from the recommendation.
It's not there. It says a relatively modest amount. I don't know what that is. It's not $412,500.
Why would he need to make such a finding when we know nothing was paid, irrespective of what his finding would be as to the ability to pay a certain amount? It's clear nothing was paid.
Because the issue then becomes, what is the liability of Bill Sadies. And we contend vociferously that he is not personally liable. He has been found not personally liable for 20 years by three different courts, including this court. And he can only be liable in a derivative fashion. That is, if the master could tell us exactly what he believed Altor could have paid, that is the limit of Mr. Sadie's liability as an officer. The man's 90 years old. He never took a salary from this company. He doesn't own a share of stock in this company. He's been held not personally liable. And footnote 4, Your Honors, is clear. When I read this opinion, I got to footnote 4. It was clear to me that neither Bill nor Nick could be held personally liable. And at the end of the opinion, we find personal liability. We find requests for disclosures of personal tax returns going back to 2012. When he wasn't liable, but he can only be derivatively liable, Your Honors. And that is a very, very important fact that I want to leave this court. This cannot be overlooked. That was an error of law, period. And without the finding of what Altor could have paid in the master's opinion, it leaves this door wide, the door wide open to assess the entire fine against Bill Sadies, which in essence makes him personally liable.
Let me ask you this. Go back to the original question this morning. Let's assume that there were a remand, and let's assume findings were made. Then what is the review standard at that point?
Well, presumably he would make a finding as to what Altor could have paid.
No, and how is that reviewed?
Well, yes. The question is if we would want to review it. I mean, that's a hypothetical question. It may be that the show cause provision in the master's order would carry the day after he made that factual finding, because then we would have the target number.
No, but would we review de novo?
If we came back and said it's incorrect. But it can't be $412,500. It can't be gross income.
What deference is given to the master's findings?
In this particular case, my argument is you have the right to de novo review, but specifically the question of what adequate modest payments are. That needs to be decided, and I think the best way to do it is to remand it back to Judge Hammer, because he's got all the documents. I also want to bring to the court's attention that there is an inconsistency in two of the recommendations towards the end of the opinion. The paragraph 2 of the recommendation is a look back, I'm sorry, a show cause for Altor and Bill to show cause whether they can afford to pay a fine. Paragraph 3 calls for a daily penalty. That's inconsistent. Also, paragraph 6 seeks Bill's tax returns from 2012. Now, under any analysis, he was not personally liable in 2012 up until this court makes a ruling and a finding on the personal liability. And again, it's derivative. He can only be responsible for what Altor could have paid. This is not punitive. It's supposed to be coercive. It's supposed to coerce the corporate entity to pay the fine, but you can't get blood from a stone.
Wait, so you're saying 2012 shouldn't be part of this? Is that your point?
I'm saying with regard to Bill Sadie's derivative liability, if we go back and we find that Altor should have paid, and I'm going to throw out a number, $100 a week, which is what Altor took out of the employee's salary and put it in the fund to reimburse the deductible. As we all know, very high deductibles exist in today's insurance, and a lot of companies set up these deductible reimbursement plans. That's nothing new, and that's not personal. But if Altor could have only paid $100 a week, that's $5,200 a year. So do the math. It's not $412,500. So in this Bill Sadie's derivative liability piece, we shouldn't have to go back to see what he had at the time. It's what Altor had. Now, it's what Bill Sadies has now to pay whatever that number is, not 7 years ago. And I might add that the secretary's brief makes a point in footnote 12, the amount that Mr. Sadies will have to pay personally, as opposed to ensuring that Altor pays what it can, remains to be determined. So once again, it is clear that this opinion, that this R&R has unfortunately reconstituted personal liability in a full amount of the fine for Bill Sadies, who has been found not personally liable by the OSHA Review Commission, reviewing the AFCON case in April of 2011, the OSHA Review Commission on the Altor case in April of 2011, by Judge Yetman in the Altor case, affirmed again by the OSHA Review Commission, and more importantly, affirmed by this court. Bill Sadies has no personal liability. And footnote four is a clear recognition by the master. The undersigned has construed the decrees to apply to Vasilios, Bill Sadies, and Nicholas Sadies in their capacities as officers or employees of AFCON and Altor, not to have required them individually to satisfy the decrees from personal assets. So why would you go back to 2012 to see what he had as personal assets?
Have you reserved time for rebuttal, Mr. Sadies?
I wasn't allowed to, and I see I'm out of time. But
Would you like 2 minutes?
I would appreciate 2 minutes. Thank you, Your Honor.
Gottlieb.
May it please the court, Ron Gottlieb for the Secretary of Labor. I'll address the standard of review issue first. The court adopted the clearly erroneous standard as the appropriate standard of review for proceedings in the appellate court in this type of proceeding. It didn't adopt the rule in the standard of review because it felt it had to apply the same rule that the district court applies when reviewing special masters. Based on the authorities that it cited, it adopted the rule because it's the same rule it applies when it reviews district court findings. And also, it was the same rule that had been applied before there were even Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. There's simply nothing in the amendment to Rule 53 that applies to district court proceedings that says that the clearly erroneous standard is no longer appropriate for Court of Appeals proceedings.
So we don't have any, there's nothing on that, right? I mean, other courts relied on the old civil rule.
Right, only the case law. But the court could adopt the rule through rulemaking if it wanted to. And, of course, it could consider the issue en banc. Those are the best ways for the court.
Well, unless there was intervening authority, which a change in a rule might be. But what's the department? So the department's position is, in all these cases, that it's clearly erroneous? That's a pretty high hill.
Well, that's what the precedent establishes. If the court believed that de novo review is more appropriate, it could do either en banc or
well, I asked your friend that about how would de novo review even work in this court?
Well, it would be hard, and that's one of the reasons that's probably one of the reasons that it's adopted the clearly erroneous. It certainly could in a case like this where there's only papers that are being construed, but the court is really looking for a rule that it should apply uniformly.
And I mean, the Supreme Court has a rule that it gives some deference, but not clearly erroneous type deference when they have original jurisdiction and they appoint a special master. Would that be appropriate?
Well, I don't think it would be appropriate to switch it for this panel to make that switch. It could be an appropriate standard to adopt either en banc or in a rule, by adopting a rule. And I would agree, another middle ground that the court could consider is in this future order appointing a special master, saying it's going to adopt it clearly erroneous unless the parties agree to de novo or agree to some other standard like right. The Supreme Court proceeding. But I don't think the court should be changing the the rule in the middle of a case at the urging of a party who's seeking to have the special.
Yeah, but I mean, it wasn't the old civil rule that sort of the sole rationale for going with clearly erroneous?
Well, no, it wasn't the only rationale. It was the rationale was also that's how they review district court's findings of fact. And also, I think it's because of the practical difficulties that you've pointed out in having to know what we do. It's just not the appellate courts, either by tradition or function or the limitations of in their structure, to have de novo fact-finding. Presumably, they could be worked out. You could have a hearing, you know, and have the three of you decide, you know, decide how you decide any other matter. But there are these structural and traditional factors that I think weigh pretty heavily into saying that the amendment to Rule 53 just is not the type of authority that undermines the precedent establishing the clearly erroneous standard.
Well, unless my colleagues have any more questions on that, do we even need to get to that issue?
Well, no, I don't think you have to get to the issue because I think under the clearly erroneous standard, even under the de novo standard, and they're in contempt for not having made any payments in towards the decree.
Was the special master required to make some finding with respect to this instead of I need not deal with this because no effort was made to come up with a lesser figure?
I don't think they had to come up with a figure as to what he could have paid because they didn't show that they couldn't pay the entire amount. And despite all the discovery that was provided, was obviously not sufficient to establish Altor's ability to pay. They rely on their tax returns and the bank statements, these are just not sufficiently reliable indicators of Altor's financial ability to pay expenses. For example, in the dissenting commissioner's opinion in the case that led to the court's decree, Altor's tax returns for 1996, 1997, and 1998 showed that it had negative income or no income and that its capitalization was $1,000 or $10,000. Yet Altor was able to finance the first 60 days of the project, of the construction project, at a cost of estimated of approximately $1 million. So the information available to the special master just didn't show that they couldn't make payments. For the documentation before the special master, the later returns and the bank statements, the important fact is that it shows that they were able to meet their expenses, and they often had thousands of dollars left over on a monthly basis. And they were able to meet their expenses from revenue from Dascon, a company that was completely controlled by Basilio Sates. And if their reply brief is to believe, they also received some money from Teresa Sates. But just as they were able to tap...
Your friend argues, well, this guy wasn't even a shareholder. He was involved in management. How do you respond to that? Phil, I'm talking about.
Yeah, his responsibility as an officer required him to use the resources available to Altor to pay their penalty. In addition, he was also a resource for the company. He had made loans too. The company has means to pay through loans, and they have to show why they can't continue to get those loans before they can just ignore the court order. And the Eighth Circuit has held that, first of all, there's no evidence that paying towards the decree would have caused them to go out of business. There's also no evidence that they had to spend the money that they spend on attorney's fees, accounting expenses, and the personal medical expenses of employees, or even health insurance. Regarding the personal medical expenses, they claim that it was from the money withheld to pay for the insurance deductible. There's absolutely no evidence that the insurance deductible, amount withheld for the covered insurance deductible accumulated over several years. That was just made up in their reply. There is evidence, however, that they returned 5,200 to Teresa Sates at the end of 2012. That's the same amount that they withheld that year to cover the deductible. They also claimed that Teresa Sates, and their suggestion that that payment was repayment of a loan is directly contradicted by their statements to the special master and the secretary that all payments to Teresa were for salary. In addition, there's no evidence that Teresa Sates made loans to the company. And there's some evidence that she made deposits, but there's no evidence to care what the deposits were. But even if they were loans, they would still be outsourced resources that they use her personal medical expenses. And it makes no economic sense for her to loan the company so they could reimburse her for her own personal expenses. And regarding personal liability, I think it's important to point out that the commission expressly stated it was only finding that he was not an employer in 1998. They expressly said they were not making any finding that he would not be personally liable in a collection action. And I don't think that, I think it's premature to say whether the money that he pays or makes sure is paid is coming from his personal account or is the money that should be available to Altor. And that's what the purpose of getting all the financial information that the special master recommended. Unless there are any further questions.
Well, so how do you envision this? We've got Judge Hammer's lengthy opinion and a bunch of recommendations. It's a straight affirm for you?
Well, the court has to enter an order. I agree.
We
should hold them in contempt.
In other words, do you agree with his recommendations?
Yes,
we agree with
the recommendations. If the court believes there's other remedies that's more likely to coerce compliance.
Well, I get that, but what is your position as to the recommendations? You're urging
we're
us
okay
to
with the
recommendations.
We didn't object to the portions that they want confirmed, so we're okay with affirming that, and we think it is.
Okay, because there's some people being let off the hook, right?
Yeah, and you know, I can't say if the standard of review was relevant to our decision not to object to those findings, you know, so I'm not going to claim prejudice or say that we should get a second bite of the apple of that, but, you know, the fact is we didn't make the objection, so we're willing to stand by that. But that is another reason not to switch the standard of review in the mid-course.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Mr. Gottlieb, Mr. Sanders.
Your Honor, I'll be very brief. First of all, we showed that the company was legally insolvent under any definition, be it the definition in SEC versus Masella, the definition in Black's Legal Dictionary, or Webster's. We had more debt than assets, and we weren't able to pay our bills in full. And if you included the judgment, we were woefully insolvent. As far as discovery, we produced every piece of paper that Altor had after the decree until the close of discovery. We produced checks, check stubs, bank statements, tax returns. So I don't know what else was missing. We produced everything. And what it showed was that these expenses were appropriate. There were no payment of personal expenses. It was a reimbursement from monies that the people otherwise would have put in their pocket from their salary.
There's been no bankruptcy filing since the briefing or anything, right?
No. But the statement that the attorney's fees shouldn't have been paid, well, I take exception to that. 3 out of 5 of the findings were in favor of my clients. So my firm accomplished something in this proceeding. So to say that the respondent shouldn't have had legal counsel and paid the decree,
the master did not say that.
No, he didn't, but he didn't say what expenses should be shaved to pay that moderate sum
That he didn't say. And that's what's missing here. That's the linchpin of this entire case, is what amount was Altor able to pay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sanders. Thank you, Mr. Gottlieb. The panel will take the matter under advisement, and we will ask the clerk to recess the proceedings.